Ich begrüße Sie recht herzlich zur heutigen Sendung Philosophische Brocken. Diesmal ein Kongressbericht vom Symposium der Internationalen Assoziation für griechische Philosophie, das 13. Symposium. Es hat vom 18. bis 25. August in Rhodos stattgefunden, dieses Jahres 2001, obwohl auf dem Programmheft 2000 steht. Aber es war dieses Jahr und ich werde einige Beiträge zum Teil einspielen, zum Teil kommentieren. Bevor wir beginnen, möchte ich eine Introduction, eine Einleitung von Yannis Xenakis bringen, eine Vertonung der platonischen Erzählung oder des Mythos von Er in der Politeia. Es wird manchen als Lärm erscheinen, es wird sich aber für andere als ein Grillenkonzert entlarven. Griechische Klänge, elektronische Klänge. Das war Yannis Xenakis, die Einleitung zu La Légende d'Air, ein Stück für Tonband 8 Lautsprecher. Der erste Beitrag, der für mich sehr wichtig war auf diesem Symposium, ist ein Beitrag über die Analogie zwischen Gorgias und dem Taoismus, beziehungsweise einem Begriff im Taoismus, dem Bian, und einem Begriff, den Gorgias in spezifischer Weise verwendet hat, dem Begriff des Kairos, der in der griechischen Philosophie, im griechischen Denken eine Schlüsselrolle gespielt hat und dann auch später im Christentum allerdings in einer ganz anderen Bedeutung. Sein Beitrag befasst sich mit dem Relativismus, der diesen beiden Begriffen innewohnt, dem Relativismus, der es gestattet, zwischen den logischen Dichotomien hindurchzugehen bzw. sie auch zu überschreiten, sie zu durchbrechen. Die Dichotomien, die Spaltungen, die Begriffspaare, die streng trennen.
The principal focus is on the Sophist Gorgias and the Taoist Zhuangzi, and a final section contemplates the confluence of their rhetorical epistemology in championing pathos over the rational logos. First, Gorgias. As all in this audience, I'm sure, are familiar, his lifetime spans the period from about 483 to about 375 BC, and he grounded his rhetoric in a relativistic epistemology in reaction to the rational logos of Parmenides. The implications of Parmenidean rationalism for rhetoric are that truth, aletheia, is objectively persuasive and depends neither on sense perception nor on the mediation of language to convey its essence. Reason alone is sufficient. So we have a contest here, as it were, between the father of philosophy, as Plato immortalized Parmenides, and the father of rhetoric, as Aristotle memorialized Gorgias. Gorgias converts the Pythagorean concept of kairos into a guide for action in the face of competing views in a speech or argument. He treats it as, quote, universal divine law, end of quote, which determines what is fitting in time, place, and circumstance. Gorgias endows kairos primarily with the meaning of inspiration and dunamis. When the speaker employs the kairos of inspiration, he invokes the poetic power of logos. In fact, Gorgias defines his art as, quote, logos with meter.
Richard Hartnett ist Professor für Education oder Higher Education Administration, um es genauer zu nennen, an der West Virginia University. In seinem Vortrag Comparative Conceptualizations of Rhetoric in Classical Greece and China hat er sich sicherlich an ein gewagtes Thema herangetastet, denn der Vergleich zwischen chinesischem Denken, chinesischer Philosophie und griechischer Philosophie ist bis heute sehr umstritten.
Let us turn now to the Taoist way of rhetoric. Taoism stands to Moism, a school of thought in China, and Confucianism as the anti-rationalism of Gorgias.
Das Durchbrechen der Sackgassen, in die uns das rationale Denken in Dichotomien, in Begriffspaaren und strengem Auseinanderhalten von Termini führt. Dieses Durchbrechen kann auf der anderen Seite auch als ein Halten des Gleichgewichts bezeichnet werden, beziehungsweise als solches konzeptualisiert werden. Das ist der Teil, den für Hartnett die chinesische Philosophie abdeckt in seiner Bezugnahme auf den Taoismus, aber nicht so sehr als dominante chinesische Philosophie, sondern als eine der Dominanzkultur des Konfuzianismus entgegenstehende Denkweise. Das Halten des Gleichgewichts, des Ganzen, ist auch ein Zusammenhalten der Extreme, die in entgegengesetzte Richtung tendieren. Auf der Seite des Gorgias, auf der Seite des Kairos, ist die gleichsam magische Kraft am Werk, durch die wir diese Extreme zu transzendieren vermögen. Für Gorgias ist der Kairos ein Aktionsprinzip, wie Harnett es darstellt. Was Harnett die Soteriology oder die Salvation nennt, ist eine Art Heilslehre, die aber keineswegs mit der christlichen Heilslehre zu vergleichen ist, deren Vorläufer wir eher in bestimmten platonischen Dialogen finden. Die Heilslehre, die hier gemeint ist, ist eine, die über die Erleuchtung durch Thou Release oder durch Taking Action bei Gorgias geht. Es geht um eine Einsichtnahme in neue, unbekannte Zusammenhänge, die nicht logisch determinierbar sind. Es geht um die Einsicht, die sich sehr wohl auf menschlicher Erfahrung gründet.
The Kairos of Gorgias and the Tao of Zhuangzi are both attempts to break the deadlock of binary opposites. For the former, in the decision whether to praise or prosecute the legendary Helen of Troy in the Encomium from Helen. For the latter, the dilemma of choosing this or that or right-wrong dichotomies. Both invoke a super-rational power to break the deadlock and delight in metaphorical language to stir the emotions, and treat the art of rhetoric as a way of knowing in its own right. In both cases, the dominant bien, or rational logos, is rivaled by a poetic logos. Although, Gorgias's anti-rationalism does not reconcile the binary opposites, but through persuasion and deceptions, inclines the listener to select one of them to break the impasse. Zhuangzi's antidote for the problem of perpetual dualism is the notion of walking with both things and reaching totality and resting in a state of equilibrium with the Tao. Two, Zhuangzi's idea of knowing how, as opposed to knowing what, resembles Gorgias's kairotic condition. In the former's stories about various craftsmen, skill is a performance that manifests a distinctive kind of knowledge in the form of adaptive responses to external changes, unification of the mental and the physical, a state of tranquility, a sense of participation in a harmonious whole. But the Taoist spiritual state transcends mere skillfulness. Resembling Gorgias's kairotic condition, it involves being moved by higher forces that can only be comprehended by evocative depictions. To approach this spiritual state, one must discard the normal reliance on language's dichotomies that are the centerpiece of rational thought. Instead, one must let the shun in Chinese, or the demonic force in the case of Zhuangzi, and in the case of Gorgias, the magical powers, to possess one and expel the conventional categories of bien understanding. In both views, in other words, spontaneous insight breaks the impasse and allows one to respond instantly and negotiate with the world. Thirdly, Gorgias' instinct is towards action by means of the logos of poetical rhetoric to overcome the antithesis of opposites. Zhuangzi's impulse is towards the Tao, as illustrated by the skillful state of living exemplified by the craftsmen in his stories who stand for the sage. Zhuangzi seems to be expressing a soteriology, a form of salvation, or at least deliverance from the prison of rationality, through the enlightenment of the Tao. In his Kairos, Gorgias also demonstrates a soteriological position when he defines it as a force that makes immanent the divine in the world. Yet we must keep in mind that Zhuangzi emphasizes the importance of gaining spiritual release, whereas Gorgias is interested in taking action. Gorgias and Zhuangzi are the voices of a counterculture that is overpowered by the mainstream thought systems in the two classical cultures. But they are particularly compelling, because their insights are grounded in human experience. They are the products of thinkers who both reflected on and practiced rhetoric. Zhuangzi embeds his rhetorical theories in the stories of practicing craftsmen. Gorgias practices his theory in an exemplum about the legendary Helen. Both raise the power of speech and paradoxical poetic prose to more than an art form. With them, it becomes a way of knowing.
Der nächste Beitrag ist ein Beitrag von John Peters. John Peters ist Professor of Communication an der University of Iowa. Sein Vortrag handelt von Phaidros, und zwar geht es ihm nicht in erster Linie um die Manier, diese zentrale Kategorie oder dieser zentrale Begriff in diesem platonischen Dialog, sondern ihm geht es um Kommunikation in ihrer Bezugnahme auf Eros oder um erotische Kommunikation bzw. kommunikative Erotik, wie sie im Phaidros von Sokrates, Platon beschrieben wird.
Facing the new medium of writing, Plato was haunted by multiplication, a term that we ought to consider in its double sense of copying and sexual reproduction. Whereas oral speech almost invariably occurs as a singular event, writing allows all manner of strange couplings. The distance influences the near, the dead speak to the living, the many read what was intended for the few. Socrates' interpretation of the cultural and human significance of the new medium of writing is governed by worries about erotic perversion. Writing disembodies thought, thus forging ghostly sorts of amatory and intellectual linkage. All of the themes of the dialogue are announced in its opening scene. Phaedrus, an eloquence junkie and impresario of the great speakers of the day, and it is of course Phaedrus who gets the speech-making rolling in the symposium and acts as the toastmaster general, happens upon Socrates outside the walls of Athens. The pastoral setting of the dialogue with the brooks, plane trees, cicadas, and grass is described, as we've heard, in unusual detail for Plato. This is a place of abduction and inspiration, a place to have one's soul swept away by words or love. And ventriloquism, I will argue, the throwing of voices is one of the key themes of the dialogue. When Phaedrus raves about a speech he had just heard that morning on the subject of love from Lysias, a distinguished medic, politician and teacher of rhetoric, Socrates' interest perks up. Phaedrus offers to recite its major points, since he has not yet committed it to memory. But Socrates, who gushingly and uncharacteristically calls himself a man who is sick with passion for hearing speeches, 228b, asks just what Phaedrus is holding in his left hand under his cloak. Upon discovering that Phaedrus has the text of the speech tucked inside, Socrates loses interest in Phaedrus's version when he can have Lysias himself. Here already the written word is figured as an erotic object concealed close to the body. In the Mae West reading of the Phaedrus, we do have to take seriously. Socrates thereupon settles down to hear the discourse as a whole, which Phaedrus proceeds to read aloud. So the mise-en-scène of the dialogue sketches the theme of the transgressive circulation of the written word, its ability to wander beyond the original context of its oral interactive presence. Just as Phaedrus and Socrates circulate outside the bounds of the city. Socrates' comment about Lysias himself being present, 228e, suggests the ghostly way that recording media can summon the absent. It also suggests the superior record of the new medium of writing over the limited power of memory. The disembodied presencing of an absent other turns out to be a theme of the dialogue, and of almost all thinking about communication since. The dialogue again presents a double drama in which performance and content coincide in the speech of Lysias. Because the setting of Phaedrus' reading to Socrates involves an erotic relation as lopsided as that which is proposed by Lysias. Phaedrus, as it happens, is the erastes of Lysias, the lover. More specifically, reading for the ancient Greeks, as Jesper Svenbro has argued, was often figured as the sexual relation between penetrator and penetrated. Since reading was almost always vocal, to write was to exert control over the voice and body of the eventual reader, even across distances of time and space. To read, which meant to read aloud, was to relinquish control of one's body to the writer, the masculine writer,
To write was to act as an erastes, to read as an eromenos, or eromenos, sorry. The writer was commonly understood as dominating and active, and the reader passive and defeated. In the opening scene of the dialogue, then, an absent author, Lysias, exerts remote control over a reader's body and voice, and in the process, his words come to unintended ears, those of Socrates. Writing allows distortions of address. Words meant for two ears only are overheard by others. Phaedrus's reading of words from his beloved that momentarily take possession of his physical being mirrors Lysias's argument itself that an asymmetrical relationship between a rational controller and a submissive beloved is best. Lysias wants to love Phaedrus in the way a book loves its readers, openly without regard to particulars.
Peters arbeitet diesen Aspekt in sehr anregender Weise heraus. Er bezieht sich in erster Linie auf das Setting der Liebhaber-Geliebten beziehungsweise der Austauschbarkeit auch zwischen Liebhaber und Geliebten. Und er vergleicht auch die Stellungen beziehungsweise die Position von Liebhaber und Geliebten in diesem Kommunikationsakt der Seelen in Anlehnung an die Gegenüberstellung zwischen Schrift und gesprochenem Wort. Der Austausch von Gedanken ist der Austausch von Seeleninhalten. Die Metaphern des Geschlechtsakts sind immer wieder präsent im Dialog. Die Metaphern des Verkehrs, der Zirkulation, Circulation, und natürlich auch die Metaphern von geschriebenem und verflüssigten bzw. verfestigten Wort. Zentral ist in seiner Herausarbeitung dieser Aspekte der Verzicht auf die Penetration in einem nicht nur wörtlichen, sondern vor allem auch metaphorischen Sinn. Der Erastes, der Liebhaber, wird dem Schreibenden gleichgesetzt. Peters arbeitet das hier unter Bezugnahme auf Swanbrough heraus. Der Verzicht auf das Schreiben wird analog gesetzt mit dem Verzicht auf die Penetration. Das Schreiben ist ein negativer Akt. Es ist eine Festschreibung und zugleich eine Anonymisierung, eine Verstreuung, eine Zerstreuung. Ebenso wichtig ist die dialogische Norm. Die dialogische Norm, die, so Peters, seit Sokrates immer wieder behauptet und neu instituiert wird.
After two visions of systematically distorted communication, Socrates offers a conception without master or slave, dominant or subordinate, platonic love, as we have come to call it, love without penetration. Two of the most characteristic Socratic gestures are the refusal to write and the refusal to penetrate, the latter described in Alcibiades' speech in the Symposium. In the Phaedrus, we discover the intimate connection between the two refusals. Both renounce asymmetrical relations. Socrates eliminates much of the customary inequality between erastes and eromenos. In contrast to the common view of the time, that symmetry in love could occur only when the heat of passion had cooled enough to allow former lovers to become asexual friends in old age, the Phaedrus describes a reciprocal kind of eros, the love of philosophical lovers. Socrates sketches an ideal of communication that remains in force to this day, souls entwined in reciprocity. This intertwining, however, is more than a melding of minds. Bodily beauty is at its heart. Writing can never achieve such a fit with its audience, and in its pretense of mutual care, writing comes in for many of the same critiques as Lysias' speech on love. Writing may claim to address its reader one-on-one, but it is in fact indiscriminate in its care. Like speeches read aloud without understanding, or youths exploited for sexual favors without love, writing is ignorant of soul and careless in its distribution. Here again, the dramatic turns of the dialogue enact the philosophical argument itself. Socrates puts the charge that writing destroys memory in the mouth of Thamus, king of Egypt, in a dialogue with Thoth. In short, Socrates is worried about paternity and promiscuity. The erotic word is not the problem, just the wrong kind of eros. For Socrates, as for many thinkers since, dialogue, fertile coupling, is the norm.
Die dialogische Norm, das Zwiegespräch, die Zweiheit, die er nicht explizit in Frage stellt, aber deren dominante Struktur er zumindest hervorhebt. Die Zerstreuung, die Vielheit, Poikilion, ist das Negative, die Deviation, der Jacques Derrida wieder zu philosophischen Ehren verholfen hat. Wobei er gewiss auch an die Diaspora gedacht hat. Die Diaspora, die, wie wir sehen werden, in einem anderen Beitrag Griechisch sprach.
Socrates faces two kinds of AI, if you will. The artificial intelligence of the written text, which simulates a caring teacher, and the artificial insemination of its distribution, which makes paternity undecidable. Writing for Socrates is something like an intellectual sperm bank. Conception can occur between anonymous partners whose junction can be manipulated across great distances of space and time. The written word unleashes a cloud of idea spores, okay, panspermia, right, that float through space, waiting to germinate and take root wherever they can. Both kinds of AI parody the full erotic presence and mutuality that Socrates calls for in philosophical lovers.
Und nun eine Nummer von Wynton Marsalis, R.G.